In 1968, as teen surfer films were finally starting to fade from the nation's movie screens, a new and very different youth obsession was blazing onto the scene. Over the next 4 years, Jimi Hendrix soared from obscurity to superstar, and today, more than 30 years after his death, he is still recognized as a guitar genius. That was from Little Wing. Those fluid, powerful solos sound like no one else before or since, and Jimi Hendrix didn't look like anyone else either. He dressed in outrageous outfits, played behind his back and with his teeth, and he lived up to his famous line, "I want to hear and see everything." Hendrix indulged his enormous appetites for sex and drugs as well as rock and roll and died of an accidental overdose at the age of 27. If you have questions about the life and death of Jimi Hendrix, about his career and his legacy, give us a call at 1-800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can send us emails, TOTN@npr.org. Charles Cross is a biographer who specializes in musicians from the American Northwest. His most recent book, Room Full of Mirrors, traces the meteoric life of Jimi Hendrix, and he joins us now from the studios of member station KUOW in Seattle, Washington. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
There's probably not a person alive that hasn't played a little air guitar while listening to Jimi Hendrix. It's comforting to know that he started out that way, too.
He did. He loved playing air guitar, and he was so poor growing up, he actually didn't have a guitar, and he played air guitar for about 2 years before he was lucky enough to finally get a guitar. So there's some small irony in all of us playing air guitar listening to him. We're just sort of following his footsteps.
You draw a wonderful picture in your book, Jimi Hendrix, a lonely superstar near the end of his life, as it turned out, going in the middle of the night on a tour of his old hometown in Seattle, Washington, picked up a fan who stopped by to get an autograph and said, "Hey, you got a car?" And drove him around the town and ends up looking through the window, putting his hands over his eyes and looking into the window of the house that he grew up in, where he played that air guitar on a broom in his little room.
You know, what was fascinating was that Jimi came back to Seattle only four times after he was famous. But every time it was almost as if he were, you know, reliving the entire life story again by going back and visiting the high school that he had dropped out of. And as you tell, they're visiting the house that he once lived in. The irony is that house is still a matter of a debate right now on whether that should be saved by the city or whether it should be torn down.
Hmm. Interesting, though. Obviously, the question of a memorial to Jimi Hendrix, that house, he was never very happy in that house.
Well, and I don't know that he was really very happy in his life, which is one of the sad things about superstardom. We want to imagine everyone that was famous and a rock star in the 60s as having a great life. And Jimi lived life to his fullest, but there was a lot of tragedy in his life that he had to overcome. He lost his mother very early, and I'm not sure that was a wound that he ever ultimately really recovered from.
You point out that in his music there are so many references, Little Wing for one, references to angels. That was his mother.
Well, that's what he said privately to his family and to other people. His mother died when he was 15 years old, and he thought of her after that point as kind of this ethereal presence in his life. And he's got a beautiful, beautiful song called Angel that is just, I think, one of the most beautiful things he ever did. And very clearly, it's a love song to his lost mother, in my opinion, at least as a critic.
One of the things, obviously a very strained relationship with his father, and questions, interestingly, of paternity. I guess Jimmy and his brother Leon, they were the only ones where questions of their father, who was their father, didn't come up.
Well, actually, no, it did come up in both of their instances. And then Leon was involved in a massive court case that just was determined last year in Seattle, where his paternity was a major issue. You know, we had a family here that Al and Lucille Hendricks had at least two kids together. And if you want to believe the court records, as many as six kids together. And, you know, in researching this biography, I found a number of brothers and sisters of Jimmy that no one had really known about. There are four other kids that Al and Lucille had that they gave up for adoption and gave away to the state. And those people really have never been talked to before, and their story's not been told. Mm. And it's pretty heartbreaking to hear their tale.
The poverty in which he grew up is hard to believe.
It is. And, you know, I always had known that he had grown up poor, but the level of poverty that he lived in was really extraordinary. And I think you almost have to understand that to understand when he gets on stage at Woodstock, how far he jumped to reach that. I think it makes the glory of his success all the greater. But certainly this was a man who began with very, very humble origins.
Mm-hmm. And I hadn't realized the extent to which his experience in the U.S. Army, as truncated as it was, how important that was in his life. For one thing, getting him out of Seattle.
Well, it got him out of Seattle. Part of that was just simply racial politics at the time. Very few African Americans in Seattle had any other job opportunities. Most ended up joining the Army. And though Jimmy grew up in Seattle, which in the Northwest we like to think of ourselves as more progressive, there still were many, many barriers to African Americans economically and housing-wise. And so he joined the Army like a lot of other young men at the time. And then he got in the Army and kind of fell out of love with it and decided he needed to get out, which is one of the funniest stories in the book, how super stud Jimi Hendrix had to pretend essentially to be the Corporal Klinger of the 101st Airborne and pretend he was gay to get out of the service.
He always told people he'd broken an ankle or something, but you found the real story.
I found the actual Army medical records, which are funny beyond belief to read, where Jimmy would go into the psychiatrist every week and say, "I'm in love with my bunkmate," and he would complain of all these other problems because his homosexuality had caused him to lose weight, he said. And Jimmy never told that story, admitted it to anyone ever later in his life, but it truly was how he got out of the service. And of course, he wasn't the only one to use that ruse.
Mm. After he did get out, he's been playing guitar then for a while. And he comes under the influence of a mentor there. Interesting expression that he uses in terms of Jimi Hendrix, the idea that he needed to acquire a little mud.
Well, that's Johnny Jones, who was a guitar player in Nashville and Indianapolis and in the South. And there's a hilarious story Johnny tells in the book of Jimmy and Johnny have the showdown. And, of course, when we think of Jimi Hendrix, we think of this incredible guitar player. Well, Jimmy came in the club and decided he was going to take Johnny on and dragged his amp and guitar in. And they both get up and do their solos. And Johnny outclasses Jimmy. And Jimmy walks away very humbled. And Johnny Jones's response afterwards is, "I'm still the man." And I love that piece because it's, you know, we imagine Jimi Hendrix as a star. We don't remember that he struggled for almost 5 years before he found stardom in music. Mm-hmm. And he once was an up-and-comer himself. And I call him a musical cannibal in the book because he so much absorbed other people's ideas.
And he learned a lot of those ideas on the old Chitlin' circuit. He toured with seemingly every R&B band in the world and got fired from most of them. And in one story you tell, he actually got traded from one band to another.
That was a hilarious story that Solomon Burke, the Undertaker and great R&B soul singer, told me of. On the bus, he swears that he traded Jimi Hendrix to Otis Redding, just like you would trade a couple of ball players. But Jimmy immediately got fired
for two horn players to be named later.
For two horn players to be named later. And at the time, of course, no one even called him Jimi Hendrix. He went under a variety of pseudonyms at the time, mostly Jimmy James and a whole mm-hmm. bunch of other names that he thought would give him more sophistication. It really wasn't until 1966, when Jimmy finally hit Greenwich Village, that he kind of discovered his own voice and his own sense of himself.
And then you say the guitarist who'd been dismissed at that showdown for trying to sound too much like B.B. King, then he started sounding like nobody else.
He did. And I think one of the more unique things about Jimmy's history that I really hadn't known going in is that, you know, his greatest influence was really not a guitar player. It was Bob Dylan. Jimmy adored Bob Dylan. And though, of course, Bob Dylan is not known as a great guitar player, I think Dylan gave Jimmy a way to imagine his own career, imagine that he could do something a little left of center. Dylan was not a great singer, and Jimmy didn't feel he was a great singer, but he so loved Dylan. And if you look at a picture of Jimi Hendrix, there are a couple in the book from 1966, you change the skin color, he looks exactly like Bob Dylan.
We are talking with Charles Cross. His new book is The Room Full of Mirrors, a biography of Jimi Hendrix. He's at the studios of member station KUOW in Seattle. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email. The address is TOTN at NPR.org. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. And let's get some callers on the line, and we'll begin with Phil. Phil calling from Honolulu.
Yes, good morning. Well, it's morning where I am.
Yeah, okay.
And it's a little bit of a stretch for me to see Jimmy looking like Bob, but I'll work on it. One of the things that I often say to young guitar players around here is that if you don't know the blues, you can't rock. And every time I hear Jimmy, I hear the blues all in what he does. And I was wondering if you could comment, and you began talking a little bit about B.B. King, but I was wondering if you could comment on Jimmy and his relationship with Buddy Guy.
Well, all those major guitar players, Buddy Guy and B.B. King and Albert King, Jimmy, when he was sort of coming up, he would go see those guys, and he would ask them for, you know, hints, for licks. And one of the more hilarious stories in the book is they didn't feel threatened by him. So Jimmy played with Buddy, I think, on a couple of occasions in clubs, and he clearly was an influence. And I think Buddy Guy is one of the only people playing today who I think really follows that legacy. You know, Buddy Guy was recently on a sort of Hendrix tribute tour and just blew everybody away by playing acoustic guitar, which was one of Jimmy's favorite instruments, actually. I don't think you need electricity to play the blues. And Buddy Guy continues in that wonderful Delta tradition, and his playing is just extraordinary to this day.
Phil, thank you.
The blues predates electricity. Thank you very much.
No, there's no question about that. Let's talk now with Walt. Walt calling from Lewis, Delaware.
Hey, how you doing?
All right.
Listen, I'd like to talk about, you know, what Hendrix be remembered for. I'm a musician and a music teacher, too, and I think his main thing was his tone. He was a sound innovator, but I think he got a lot of what he did from two people. It's your biographer, correct me if I'm wrong. Ike Turner and Sonny Chirac.
Yeah, I think that some of that's true. I mean, I think Jimmy was influenced by so many people, but one story that I was able to confirm in this book that hadn't really been confirmed before is that Jimmy did very briefly play with Ike and Tina Turner. Tina Turner denies that, and I think that part of it is that no one knew Jimmy as Jimi Hendrix at the time, but Ike does confirm that Jimmy was in that band for a while. And he was, you know, he was kind of like a sponge. He just sucked up influences from everyone that he saw, yet he was able, I think, to put a unique twist on it. I do think one other important thing, though, beyond music, is one reason to remember Jimmy, and that simply is the issue of race. Jimmy was really one of the very first African-American artists to have a large following of white fans. And for that fact alone, he was quite revolutionary. And I think that, you know, in our modern mixed ethnicity society today, we kind of forget how revolutionary that was to have a black man playing to such huge audiences of white fans. And Jimmy himself commented in his diary on that, what a strange irony that was, that he had found that audience.
Yet he did not, when he lived, have a big black audience, and in fact always wanted to go up and be a big hit in Harlem.
He did. And one of the, again, a hilarious story in the book is how just 2 weeks after Woodstock, you know, Woodstock is the show we identify as Jimmy's pretty much his greatest moment and maybe the highlight of the entire 60s on a musical spectrum. But 2 weeks later, Jimmy played for free in Harlem to about a few thousand African-American fans at a street festival, and he was booed. And that was something that he was tormented by. He really wanted a larger African-American audience and found that, you know, black radio stations would not play his records. And that was frustrating to him.
Thanks very much for the call, Walt.
All right. I have one more question, if you could answer it.
Go ahead, quick.
Yeah, there have been a lot of Hendrix biographies. What's different about yours?
Good question.
Well, I approached this biography and all the work I do is I'm not so much writing a biography of a musician, but as an important cultural figure. And I talk a little bit, obviously, about what Jimmy plays and what his musical accomplishments are, but I don't think you can understand his work unless you understand his life. So I try to give equal weight to every year of his life. And many of the other books that have been written, you know, Jimmy's first 18 years, which was the first two-thirds of his life, might take up two or three pages. In my book, it's half of my book, and certainly I'm as concerned with the making of the man as I am the making of the guitar. And I don't think you can understand the depth of that blues guitar solo that we heard on Little Wing unless you understand Jimmy's mother, his family, his entire family's history, the fact that he was born from a family that included slaves and Native Americans. And there is a long tradition there that you must understand, I think, before you can really understand the artistry.
Thanks,
so that's my approach.
And Charles Cross, thank you. We appreciate your time today.
You're welcome.
Charles Cross is the author of Room Full of Mirrors. He was at the studios of KUOW in Seattle, Washington. Let's leave you with the song of the same name. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.